La 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 la. Hi everyone, it's that time of the week again. So welcome to the EdTech Podcast, the show about education innovation in and out of the classroom. My name is Sophie Bailey, and this week we're talking about investment, startups and accelerators in this episode recorded at South by Southwest EDU. But before all of that, thanks to everyone who's filled out the listener survey so far. Some of the feedback we've had is super interesting, and one requested guest was the Singularity University, which I'm working on as we speak. So every entry does count, and if you want to add your feedback, go and check out the show notes. A quick thanks also at Mama Codes for hosting a coding evening this week, and to Educator Investor who also held their summit, which we popped along to. This week, I'm excited to announce that the EdTech Podcast will be an official co-chair at the first London EdTech Week commencing on the 19th of June. Much of this week's episode looks at how to value EdTech, and this is exactly what I'll be tackling in a live podcast held in collaboration and at Nesta on the evening of the 19th of June. We will be asking, is EdTech a thing, and looking at whether it should be considered an investment, an opportunity cost, an asset for global competitiveness, or a social initiative. The live podcast will bring together a VC, early stage investor, school business and government perspective, and our event sponsor is Cooley Legal Practice. Registration is now open and is free, and the link is in the show notes. I can't wait to spark an interesting discussion and move the dial from how much is being invested to where value is being generated. In other news, I'm very excited to announce that the Japan Prize will be sharing their message with the EdTech Podcast. Here's a snippet from my conversation with Yuki Yoshida, Deputy Secretary General of the NHK Japan Prize, with more details.
Hello.
Hello, good morning to you.
Good morning, how are you?
Good, and you?
Very well, thank you. Yeah, we had a really nice weekend in London. It was very sunny. Perhaps you could explain to listeners what the Japan Prize is.
Okay, my pleasure. First of all, NHK is Japan's public broadcaster. So, and we usually produce almost every genre of content, like TV programs and radio programs. And but also, NHK put much importance on education. And one of the international brands to represent that value or almost expressing our how determined we are about quality or equal access to education is the Japan Prize. It's an international competition for educational media. And so we launched this competition in 1965. So we welcome all of the audiovisual contents, not only TV programs and videos and films, but also we welcome all the digital contents as well, such as website and games and applications. So this is pretty much about what we are.
And so in terms of who should enter, are there any particular types of digital companies, edtech companies, who should definitely enter? And are there any that you're thinking in the future may be eligible but aren't this time around?
Okay, so because we are public media broadcaster, now we're welcoming the content which has any type of audiovisual contents in their services. So like website or across, even though it's a cross media content, like teaching kids as a programming or coding, the content should have some sort of audiovisual content in that service. So maybe some sort of like a robot who are controlled by the coding, but if that robot doesn't have audiovisual contents at the moment, I think I'm sorry to have to tell that I think we have to wait for a little more to come to welcome those contents.
So it's the audiovisual bit that's the important aspect.
That's right, yes.
Okay, and then is there a cost to enter?
No, there is no entry fee, so any contents are welcome, and we already opened the call for entry for this year. So you can just simply visit our website, and we have all the entry rules and entry forms. Links are there.
Okay, great. And then the deadline is the 30th of June this year. Is that right?
That's right, yes. Okay. So until that light, we have about two steps to enter. One is the filling out the online entry form. And after we accept the entry form, we will send you the email to your the links to upload your contents. And so the finishing the uploading the contents, it should be done by the deadline, which is just like you said, at end of the June. So that's www.nhk.or.jp/prize.
If people enter and they're successful, what's the benefit? What's the next step if they go on to be nominated or win?
Right, okay. So after the deadline, we have a preliminary selection process during the summer. We are announcing the finalist on September the 1st. And after you are nominated, some of the category, not all the all of the category, but you are welcome to present your works in Tokyo. Especially for the EdTech listener, I think it's one of the good news, I hope, is that one category, which is heavily focusing on digital content, which we are calling Creative Frontier category, these are five or six finalists are usually nominated as a finalist. And these finalists are invited by NHK. We are paying your travel cost. You are invited to Tokyo to present your project in front of the final jurors.
And
so that will, yeah, so you have a free ticket to Tokyo.
Okay, fantastic. And then the award giving ceremony, that is in the autumn, is that right?
Yes, the final selection will be scheduled from October 11th to October 18th. The final date, October 18th, is the award ceremony. So this is the one day which we, you know, announced all the winners. And we have a best of the best prize, which is called the Grand Prix Japan Prize. So these are, you know, presented all the winners. And we have a prize money. Each of the best category, we have $2,000 for the winner. And also we have $5,000 for the Grand Prix winners. So I think it's I hope it's a good information for you.
Yeah, no, I think it's very good. I think a lot of people will be excited and interested to enter. So thank you very much for sharing, Yuki. Do you have any final message to potential entrants?
Well, we all the believing in the power of media and power of technology to change the world for the better place. And the Japan Prize is a very unique place for those people who get together and discuss how the media can communicate to the world in the learning aspect. So we're really looking forward to your submissions, and we're really looking forward to welcoming you to Tokyo in October.
That's great. So thanks very much, Yuki.
Thank you, Sophie.
Awesome. I hope that got you excited. If you're not eligible to enter, make sure you recommend the prize to your favourite edu resources out there. This week's episode is also brought to you by sponsors Class Central and Glisser EDU, with a few words from them later on. Now, on to this week. We're in conversation with Matt Candler, founder and CEO of 4.0 Schools, Chan Gong, investor at Reach Capital, Phil Kim, the co-founder of Mikkelsen Runway EdTech Accelerator and president of the Mikkelsen 20mm Foundation, and Myra Lombera, director also for strategic initiatives at the Mikkelsen 20mm Foundation, Avi Warshawski, CEO at Mindset, Titi Wiandu, VC at Pearson Affordable Learning Fund, and Tomoko Hinida, a Frill Company Limited on behalf of EdTech Japan. We're talking about where is money currently being invested into EdTech, what are the various accelerators and incubators focusing on and why, and how does EdTech differ from Vietnam to Israel to Japan to the USA? As always, send me your feedback to @podcastedtech or to speakpipe.com/theEdTech podcast, and have a great week. So, back in the Hilton, I'm delighted to be with Matt Candler, who is the CEO and founder, I'm guessing,
yes,
of 4.0.org. So, welcome, Matt.
Sophie, it's good to be with you. Thanks for coming to the States.
Yeah, no, it's great to be here. I'm having a wonderful time. For those listening in, can you give us a whistle-stop tour of what 4.0 is, how you got into it, and what your mission is, really?
Sure. So, 4.0, as we call it in the States, but you can call it 4.0. We had a horrible logo, by the way, in our first year, and everyone, we made headbands and went to a conference, and everyone thought it was 40 schools. So if you call it 4.0, it's delightful because it's...
I'm like the queen of mispronunciation. I think I call Kano, Kano, South by Southwest Edu rather than Southwest Edu.
Yeah, it's been called many things. 4.0. So it's 6 years old now. Started in New Orleans, which is where I moved a few months after Katrina hit New Orleans. Was involved with the charter school work there, which is what I had done for many years prior. And over time, 4.0 has evolved into what we call a community. I think over the last 6 years, about 700 people have come through a variety of different programming and training and community event work that we've hosted. And about 100 of those folks have launched new ed tech ventures, new school models, or what we call modular learning spaces. These are spaces that are not necessarily the school of record for a child, but they're a place either virtual, mobile, or bricks and mortar where a child goes to learn a particular topic. For example, a maker space or a coding lab or a writing lab, a robotics lab, for example. And we have a lot of kit-based and mobile lab-based learning spaces that are in that mix. And overall, that group of alumni serve more than 1 million kids, mostly in the States. But I think... names that we appreciate people trying to put on us, but we say aren't actually a good fit are things like Accelerator. We're very much earlier than the traditional Accelerator.
Yep.
We meet folks when there's just a hunch or an idea buried in their brain, and much of our work is designed to get that idea out into the world and in front of students and families in its very first iteration.
Mm-hmm.
And then follow that entrepreneur, often not even calling themselves an entrepreneur yet, or maybe never, through the first few versions of that idea as it plays out as a potential solution for students and families.
Is the main outcome for your organization to create revenue-generating sort of edtech organizations, or is it to create meaningful value add for the community, and whether something, a business is off the back of that, great, but it's not the first priority.
The second is absolutely the priority. It is rooted in a belief that there are virtually no venues for folks who want to make school better to try their ideas out in the earliest stages.
And so what's the physical space that's manifested in? So is it multiple spaces?
Great question. I mean, the last few years have been a struggle to find our footprint across the U.S. In New Orleans, we have a 5,000 square foot facility. That includes space for our small group of 10 and about 15 of our alumni office with us. And then in that facility, once a month, we host a workshop called Essentials. People from all over the U.S. and some folks even from Europe and elsewhere come to this 3-day workshop. And you leave that workshop with in your hand a plan to run a pop-up version of your school or your ed tech product. And if it is ed tech, there's no code involved. Mm-hmm. It's just paper prototyping and early stage user engagement. So we run that program once a month. And then twice a year, we bring in a cohort of between 30 and 40 teams, upwards of 50 people, through a program we call the Tiny Fellowship. And the goal of that program is to put forth a week to month long pilot of your program in your local community. So you come to New Orleans to our facility to do the planning and the rough draft of your test. And then we send you home with a small grant, around $100 to $1,000 at Essentials, and a $10,000 what we call wallet, which is a combination of cash and coaching that you get to personalize based on what you're testing and where you are personally. And the Tiny Fellowship, you're completing that second stage of the testing process. If you go through both of these, you've gone from idea to community-based prototype and pilot. That typically is a very attractive place to be if you then want to move on to an accelerator or a local incubator.
And so how do you fund it?
primarily through philanthropy.
Yeah.
We've been very fortunate to receive support from some philanthropists who are typically involved in the reform movement in the U.S., the Walton Family Foundation, mm-hmm. Bill and Melinda Gates, Kauffman Foundation, and then a number of local funders in New Orleans. Phyllis Taylor at the Patrick Taylor Foundation, Booth Bricker is another foundation that's been heavily involved in work in New Orleans schools since the storm. But we do earn a little bit of our own keep. We charge a small fee. We'll waive it if you can't afford it, of a few hundred dollars for essentials. We don't charge for the tiny fellowship. We do not take a stake in our companies. Many mm-hmm. folks ask us to, but because we're so early stage, the transaction costs and the legal paperwork to do that often outweighs the benefits. And frankly, you know, if we were to leverage any of our equity investments, we'd have to have a huge pile of cash somewhere to keep from being diluted over time. And I'd probably run 4.0 into the ground long before we got paid back. So we've struggled with that. Should we take a piece of these companies? And we've made a pretty firm decision to say no. And that's partly because back to what the point is. The point mm-hmm. is not to to put fire in the fireplace of the accelerator and the investor community. The primary purpose of our work is to encourage local leadership to take those first steps.
And how do you measure the success of
It's very hard. It's hard. We work with a number of foundations and scientists and researchers to ask these questions. We're very much in the process of asking these.
Yeah.
How do you measure an idea when it's still in that early phase? Like, how do you measure Facebook when Zuckerberg's in his dorm room?
Which is what a lot of people are struggling with now, certainly in the UK. There's, you know, huge emphasis on efficacy, measurement, and I've been to a couple of events where there's always a startup puts a hand up, you know, excuse me, we're still iterating. We don't even know what the product is.
Yeah.
So how can I measure that en masse, and especially if that costs hundreds of thousands of pounds? So
it's very, you know, one of my professors at business school, Mohan Sawhney, described the world of metrics in three categories. You have input and output metrics, which are self-explanatory, and we typically obsess about output metrics. But process metrics is a very fascinating world. And so I think if you look at the metrics that we use internally, predominantly process metrics. How long did it take you after you went home from Essentials to run that one-day pop-up? How quickly did you spend that $100? What did you spend it on? For what it's worth, a lot of people spend it on food just to get people together. When you do a pilot, say a week-long pilot of a makerspace, for example, or even better, a reading laboratory like 826 Valencia is a great example, or Big Class is another reading laboratory in New Orleans that we work with, you can actually take some baseline measures in the front and back end and during a week-long pilot. How much do you read by yourself at home? Mm-hmm. When was the last time you wrote something by yourself? And then either at the end of that week or months after, poll those children again. Mm-hmm. Are you writing more? Do you enjoy writing more? What are you reading? What are you writing? So at the individual pilot level, there's quite a bit of data that we can capture. Mm. It's virtually impossible to aggregate that and say, this is the data point that represents the punching power or efficacy of 4.0. But I have been really encouraged by that there is a very rich world of data here when you decouple that conversation from the explicit downstream impact, right, on a large
Which
aggregated
a lot can
group
be vanity
of kids.
Metrics anyhow. So
very often, right? I mean, more often than not, those are. You mentioned capital, right? I think so. In the States, I have an opinion that downstream capital is perversely distributed. It tends to. We just don't have many IPOs here. We have a lot of acquisitions. Some of them are done to kill off a potential threat to an incumbent. And much of that capital exists in fairly old school, for the most part, publishers and other constituents that are very much incented to work with the existing system because they have a lock on it. So I tend to be a little bit skeptical of arguments that are rooted too heavily in funding as a metric of success. And finally, I think because we're so early, we actually take pride in spending as little as you can. right? Yep. And just this basic idea of lean development and rapid iteration and small testing is very much in conflict with much of the more mature investing community, which is very often extremely incented to get as many people spending as much money as possible so that they can get that stake quicker and they can move their money downstream to the next stage as quickly as they can.
Final question, which I always ask everyone, is there a book, person, a resource, something or someone that you follow on Twitter, anything like this that perhaps is someone that you or something that you go back to that shapes the way you think?
Oh man, so hard. I have a there's a book list that we read. There is a there's an official canon of books in 4.0.
We're creating the same thing with the EdTech podcast.
So I'd love to share.
All the guests, you know, give their books and then we have a list of them.
So in that canon.
We should swap.
Yeah, I'd love to swap. So in the canon, folks like Lisa Delpit, a book called Other People's Children, Stephen Johnson, Where Good Ideas Come From, anything about the Bell Labs, and other sort of pockets of innovation. But I'll tell you what I am crushing on right now. This is my side hustle or hobby is converting old motorcycles to electric drive. And I'm reading a book right now on battery technology and others and other topics. I continue to be very intrigued by the world of clean energy and how it relates to fossil fuels. I was having a discussion this morning. So the tip I read and listen to another podcast. I'll make sure it's second the order of reading to the EdTech podcast. But as soon as the EdTech podcast is done, my Stitcher will play Green Tech Media's Energy Gang. So I just really find it fascinating whether you're looking at autonomous vehicles or clean energy, how we are trying to get off of fossil fuels to a world where there is abundant energy, where we can leverage private cars the way Uber did magically with their sort of asset-light business model. If you take that kind of framework and apply it to our industrial age construct of school and look at students as that untapped asset, the same. So the analogy is students are to solar power, free, clean, available every day, as
not always clean.
adult professional teachers and the adults in the system are to fossil fuel. That might be a very violent analogy to make.
The issue is not with them, it's with the people that are.
I think it's just to challenge the notion that we have to mine adult resources on behalf of students and that our balance sheet is stacked full of adult resources. When if you just use the example of the autonomous vehicle or Uber, or even solar leasing in that world, there's this whole other class of assets that are off the balance sheet of the traditional school that are in fact very leverageable for this thing we call learning and teaching.
And so that, things like peer-to-peer grading.
Absolutely.
And, like
and explicitly saying this is not about student-to-student learning, because there's still a passivity in that term that you can fall prey to. So if we push it and say student-to-student teaching and explicitly say what we're investing in 4.0 is organizations led by human beings who believe that students can teach other students. And whether it's micro schools or learning spaces or ed tech. So we only invest in ed tech that is student or family facing.
Yep.
We don't invest in ed tech that is school facing. But I believe that. I believe the same way I believe in the power of wind and solar as a remarkably clean and available resource we should do more to capture and use. I believe in the power of students, again, not as better learners, but as teachers of themselves, of other students, and of us. And that's such a subtle shift, but I think it's an important one to make. And I actually prefer to read outside of education for inspiration on that.
So we'll swap each other's list. In the meantime, if people want to get hold of you, so your Twitter is at M Candler,
yes.
C-A-N-D-L-E-R. And how about the 4.0.
Four letters and then .org, the number four, sorry, two numbers and two digits and two letters, four, the number four, P as in Paul, T as in Tom, the digit zero, .org. And then our blog, where we talk a lot about what's in our head, is futureofschool.org.
Future of School. Wonderful. Thank you so much, Matt.
So good to talk to you, Sophie.
Next up, a word from Class Central, which, if you're into geeking out over online learning and MOOC reports like I am, you'll probably already know about. Unless you've been asleep, MOOCs or massive online open courses are changing the way we experience higher and further education and workplace learning. With significant online courses available, gaining insight into this fast-paced world is worth spending time on, especially for those implicated by such changes. That's where Class Central comes in. Not only does it list hundreds of courses, and importantly, including non-profit courses as well as the big Ivy League unis, but the MOOC Report blog has some excellent analysis on what's up, down, new, or just slightly left-field. So definitely go and check it out at www.class-central.com/report and let me know what you think. So it's Tuesday the 7th, and I'm delighted to be here with Chan Gong from Reach Capital in Palo Alto in California. So welcome, Chan.
Thank you.
And so I suppose why I reached out was, you know, come over from the UK, and we've had a couple of EdTech investors on the show. So we've had Deborah Crazzo that I mentioned, and an angel EdTech investor in London called Richard Taylor. But I was really interested to know more about Reach Capital, who you invest in, and also just to get your sense of where you think the investment in EdTech is happening at the moment.
Absolutely. So we're EdTech impact investors. We invest kind of across the spectrum, but our core focus is US K-12 education. We've done some early childhood investments and some higher ed, but really thinking about getting students from cradle to college and thinking about that completion rate is really important to us. Our investments, I think we have 20 something companies now in our portfolio, and it spans a number of different focus areas, everything from like data and differentiation to communication, to some AI focused pieces as well. And so we're really excited about the portfolio, and really look for products in particular that can scale. So that both the tech piece and then scale within beyond just kind of private schools, but really being able to be used in like a large public district.
And are you seeing any kind of stranglehold on investment in terms of it slowing down, or just because I guess there's quite a lot of changes that are going on at the moment? So is that affecting investment or not so much?
So I think relative to some other industries like clean energy, I think education actually, ed tech feels less impacted. I would say it's still TBD. A lot is yet to come. But from what we see so far, I think it hasn't necessarily slowed down investment. Yeah. And generally speaking, I think there's been some qualms, I think, recently from other investors about K-12 versus higher ed or lifelong learning. And I think we still really believe in K-12. And for example, I think Nearpod recently raised a pretty large round, and I think it is a testament to K-12 really being a promising space.
And at home, I mean, I was having a conversation yesterday with some people at the opening party, and we were talking about, it was an EdTech startup, it's very well known in the UK, and that gap between sort of those early rounds and then the kind of more significant rounds. I don't know if you have something similar here, but certainly at home there's a feeling that there's a gap in the middle there.
Definitely. And so I think the origins of Reach Capital really came from feeling like there was a gap actually in the early stage. And I think over the past 5 years, we've seen a lot more activity in this space. And so now what we're seeing is there's actually kind of this gap where seed has grown. It's become a larger investment. Typical round now, I think, is 1.5 to 2.5 million. I'd have to double check that. But whereas
well,
it used to be
like
it used to be smaller. Like, and so our original checks, I think, with the New School Seed Fund was actually closer to 50 to 150K. And now our typical check size is like 500K.
Wow.
But what we've seen is a lot of companies raise that seed round, but they aren't quite ready to, in terms of metrics, to be able to raise a successful Series A. And so what we're seeing now is like oftentimes a post-seed round, where either it's an inside round with a lot of their existing investors, or maybe one or two new investors join.
And how do you distinguish Reach Capital to some of the other investors out there that are well known in this space?
So I would say we have probably the strongest seed pipeline out of any of the investors, at least in the U.S. around EdTech. I think in last year we saw 90%+ of all funded seed deals through our pipeline. Most of it's all inbound. And so really, I think where that comes from is we have a really great entrepreneur network and funder network. And so through that, and I think the support that we like to think we're giving to our portfolio companies, they can maybe let us know whether or not that's actually happening. But I think that plus our community is really what drives our investment.
And do you have educator advisors on your board?
Yeah, so we actually have what we call our education advisors, and it's actually a panel of educators, both more on the leadership side as well as in the classroom, to really gut check and give us feedback. And they're also available to support our portfolio companies. And so sometimes when we're trying to better understand how things are working in terms of school budgeting or in terms of curriculum, there are sounding board and feedback. And similarly, we also actually have a panel of what we call Jedis, who are kind of experts in terms of growing companies. And so we'll tap them for help around sales and marketing or how to think about customer success and supporting teachers in the classroom.
And do you work with any incubators or accelerators?
So most of what I mentioned just now is all in-house, or we partnered specifically with individual consultants, but we do have great relationships with a number of the incubators, so everything from Dream It to Learn Launch to Intel, Michelson Runway. We're involved with all those, and either we'll support through panels or give investor feedback. We love that there's a whole ecosystem growing here.
And I mean, what's your opinion on EdTech? So, you know, if I were to ask you in a nutshell what you thought, because I guess that there's that thing about, you know, if you stack it up against other sectors and the jury's still out on finances, and obviously you have to look at it slightly different. It's not necessarily about a quick rate of return on investment and that kind of thing. So just interested in your own philosophy on the whole sector.
Yeah, so I would say that similar to many other sectors, I think there's a whole spectrum in terms of the types of return you can get depending on the types of companies. For us at Reach, I think we have a little more patient capital. We are impact investors, and so we look at companies that maybe might take longer to scale, but we think part of what they're doing is really creating that market and then building into it. And so for me, I'm really, I guess, maybe obviously since I'm working in this space, very bullish about EdTech. I think that it has so much potential in terms of transforming lives. And I think also just in thinking about the return piece, I think EdTech is really, we're just at the surface. I think it's the first wave was really just infrastructure, getting internet in schools and putting computers physically in schools. And then there was like that first wave of not super innovative, but it was just like digitizing existing content.
Yes.
And I think we're only now just getting to the part of like really personalized learning and using technology to not just incrementally improve education, but really transform the way we learn and make it meaningful and more engaging. And so that's what I'm really excited about.
And are you able to share some of the companies in your portfolio, just give a flavor of who you've invested in as well?
Sure, absolutely. So one example is Newzella. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it.
Rings a bell,
yeah, but what I really love about the product is it's something that kind of meets educators where they are and doesn't require a ton of like sophisticated technology to get off the ground. But really the idea is bringing relevant nonfiction content into the classroom. Mm-hmm. So students, for example, can all read the same news article and discuss it in class, but it'll be leveled to different reading levels for each student. And it also provides like really easy assessment and feedback. And so it provides more data to the teacher, provides more engaging content for students, and it's all differentiated so that different students can read at their own reading level but still be included in that same discussion. So those types of products I think are what we really love.
And you mentioned EdSurge as well before.
Yes.
So that's one.
EdSurge is in our portfolio. ClassDojo, SchoolMint. There's a blend of both, kind of more classroom tools and then also school infrastructure like SchoolMint.
And so it's quite an international crowd that listen in. So do you invest solely in domestic products, or would you be interested in startups from elsewhere as well?
So to date, we've been focused on U.S. Market. That said, a lot of our portfolio companies have expanded beyond that. I know, especially like UK, Australia, New Zealand and Canada tend to be large markets for a lot of our products as well. So ClassDojo, for example, I think has a pretty strong presence there.
I mean, what was your own experience of education like?
Yeah, so for me, I'm a product very much of public schools. So I grew up in Durham, North Carolina, and went to Durham Public Schools, and then moved to California and went to high school here in the Bay, in San Francisco Bay Area, and then went to University of California, Berkeley. So for me, yeah. I think that whole experience, I think, had its ups and downs. There were definitely moments where school was not that valuable to me, and I didn't feel like I learned that much. But there are also moments where I connected with really incredible educators, and I feel like I couldn't be where I am today without them.
Do you have any books, resources, or people that you think have shaped your way of conducting yourself in the world?
I would say these days a lot of what I do is driven a lot by the team I work with. I think they're actually a very diverse and very different set of people, but bring a lot of different perspectives.
Oh, that's nice.
So one that I've come back to a couple times that I love is Paul Tuff's How Children Succeed, Great Curiosity and the Hidden Power of Optimism. I just feel like it gives a very unique perspective to like the importance of those softer skills. And I think that's something that in EdTech, I think we're still trying to figure out whether or not EdTech is the right tool to even help with that. But I think feel like it's really important and are trying to understand more.
So it's the end of the day on Monday, and I'm delighted to be here with my two colleagues from the Mikkelsen 20mm Foundation. To kick off, could you both introduce yourselves and what you do, and then we'll go into what you're doing here as well at South by Southwest EDU.
Sure. This is Phil Kim. I'm president of the foundation.
And I'm Myra Lombera. I'm the director of strategic initiatives for the Mikkelsen 20mm Foundation.
Wonderful. And then for those listening who aren't familiar with the foundation, could you just give us a kind of whistle-stop tour of what you do and the history of how that came into being as well?
Sure. So we started about 8 years ago as a 501c3 based in Los Angeles. We are funded entirely by Dr. Gary Mikkelsen, who was a spinal surgeon by training, but made his fortune as an inventor. And chances are, if you've had a spinal procedure done or know somebody that has, they've used one of the Mikkelsen technologies. And, you know, he came from humble beginnings and really has always had a passion for education, particularly access and equity and giving people the opportunity to kind of find a better life and meaningful career. We set out, you know, a number of years ago to hopefully open up things for students in the higher ed segment in particular, with a focus initially on open educational resources that, you know, would address some of the cost issues that were created by the then really problematic textbook publishing industry, which we've seen some improvement since then. But we funded a program called OpenStax College out of Rice University alongside the Hewlett Foundation and Gates Foundation, with the idea that we could build a catalog of publisher-grade textbooks that could compete with, you know, the best titles from the Pearson and McGraw-Hill and those catalogs, but do so under an open license that was fully flexible and personalizable for faculty and students, and at no cost and online. So, you know, fast forward 5-6 years, there are now 30 books in that catalog. Some of those titles have as much as 10-11% market share in some key subject areas. So we've been very happy with that and kind of continuing to support this idea of opening up access to education. And about 2 years ago, we also set out in earnest to build out a social impact investment platform where we would support very early stage for-profit startups that really spoke to our need for sort of sustainable and scalable change in those areas of access, and then as we expanded into workforce development and other areas within the sort of higher ed segment. So really taking a focused approach there to de-risk some of these companies that were struggling to find traditional venture investment. And hopefully providing the patient capital that was comfortable with the education space and, you know, able to work alongside those founders to bring some of these products to market.
And then you mentioned the third part about the student debt as well.
Yes.
So very interested in that.
So this year, a new initiative that we've been incubating for 12 months now and sort of following the space of the income share agreement world, which has really been spearheaded by the effort at Purdue for the most part with their Back a Boiler program. But the idea that as an alternative to student debt, which just has not served anybody well, as we've kind of arrived at this point, and I think everyone knows that problem pretty well, but that we could invest in sort of the future of students through an equity vehicle. Mm-hmm. So rather than providing them with a loan, you'd have an underwriter come in and provide sort of tuition or whatever fee was required, and then recoup that investment as a percentage of earnings in the years following graduation. And it's an idea that's been around for some time. And I think if you, as we spoke of, when you talk to people from the UK and other parts of the world, that seems to be the most logical and reasonable approach. But for whatever reason, I think in part because you know, a lot of the student loans were operated and subsidized in the U.S., you know, that really became the predominant form of financing for students. But now that we've sort of seen the shortcomings there, we feel like the income share agreement space really has some room to build momentum. So we're working with I think initially with some local coding academies that provide those very focused immersive programs for coders to skill up, which are pretty costly. You know, for the most part, it's a $13,000 to $15,000 price tag for one of these programs. So, you know, you're getting a lot of those students that can't afford it, but those underrepresented groups that you traditionally see falling by the wayside in higher ed are similarly sort of lost in the mix for coding academies. So our hope there is to build a program that can fund some of these students through these vehicles, these ISA, income share agreement vehicles, and hopefully prove out that model to your traditional impact investors that this is another sort of vehicle that can generate reasonable returns, but also achieve those important impact goals that they might have by bringing this opportunity to students that wouldn't otherwise have it.
And I think one of the key components of this initiative is that we're aligning interests on all levels. So it's not just looking at how we're educating and preparing these students, but also how having a promise to them that they'll find employment that guarantees them a minimum earning potential. It really helps us to make sure that all interests are aligned. So the institution is helping you find a job. They're mm-hmm. guaranteeing you a minimum salary. And if they're not providing you with employment opportunities, then they're not doing their job at the end of the day. And we think that that's one of the key issues in higher education today, that we're graduating students, but we're not getting them into the workforce. We're not helping them earn middle income.
And do you have a kind of criteria in terms of the types of students you're trying to reach to sort of address some of those equity issues?
Yeah, so I think it really is, I think, a double bottom line approach. So we will evaluate sort of credit worthiness and academic aptitude of the students to make sure that we are proving out a model that is palatable for other investors. We'd love to build a great pilot, but really, if it doesn't inspire and give confidence to other funding organizations to come in and do this at scale, we won't feel that we've been successful. So we do want to make sure that we are doing the diligence there with the students, but we are 100% focusing on those groups that, you know, that are not well represented in those programs and in tech companies in general. Mm-hmm. So certainly women, people of color, people from economically disadvantaged backgrounds. Our hope is that we'll be able to prove out that in giving people the means to access those types of programs to skill up, there's a sustainable model there.
So Myra, you're here, you're at South by Southwest EDU today. What's kind of been the objective for you as an organization? So when you're meeting people here or some of the presentations that you've heard that have kind of resonated with your mission?
I think we're definitely looking at sourcing great companies and working with entrepreneurs that are already doing a lot of the work in this space. Yeah. We have our second cohort we run an accelerator program called Michelson Runway in partnership with an incubator out of San Francisco. And we invested in our first five companies this past year, looking at things like re-enrollment and workforce development areas. And for this next year, we're going to be investing in another 5 companies. So we're really focused on making sure that we're sourcing those seed stage companies that are getting some traction and supporting these entrepreneurs.
And so if people are listening in and they're thinking, oh, that sounds exciting, what's the kind of, where do they need to be based?
Sure. So it's a virtual program. Okay. Everybody has the option of officing out of the Twitter building on Market Street. It is a fantastic space. You'll be sitting alongside 80 other startups. The energy is great. The community is unmatched. You're going to find mentors and advisors and investors and certainly even development talent. But it's a virtual program for those that want to keep their company and their families where they are. And we provide a little bit of startup funding, a great advisor and mentor network, legal and accounting, and all of those great freebies that come along with traditional accelerator programs. And then a unique element, which we've been very proud of, and I think we'll even expand on in the coming cohort 2, is the research component, where we've hired on a dedicated researcher to work with each of the companies and create a tailored plan to measure efficacy and data points that not only sort of cycle back and help them improve their products, but then also provide them with marketable points that they can use in reaching out to customers, in generating follow-on funding interest. It's been, I think, from feedback, a very helpful part of the program that we certainly hope to continue.
So from someone outside of the U.S. coming here, what are the big educational issues?
Definitely. I think one of the key issues that we hear time after time with all of our partners that we're talking to is engagement. How do we make sure that we're engaging our students? How do we make sure that we're supporting them with an immersive experience that helps with persistence, that helps with graduation, that really helps get students not just in, because access is part one, but then funneled through the system and making sure that we're graduating them. The fact that we have only 55% of our students are graduating in higher education, it's
crazy,
really atrocious.
Wow.
It's a huge problem. Yeah, so we're certainly providing them with enough different entry points that students have an opportunity to pursue higher education, but we're not graduating them. And if you look at low-income populations, for example, and certain impoverished areas, the numbers are far lower, as low as 18% graduation rates. And those are some of the things that we need to address.
And one question I always ask interviewees is, are there any books or resources or people that have had an impact on the ways that you think and how you conduct yourself sort of personally through life? And that doesn't have to be educational. It could be, you know, a book or resource or a person that you go back to that you think, actually, yeah, that shaped me quite a bit. how gentlemanly of you to offer it
up?
You're like, you can go back.
I think one of our advisors, Ryan Craig, who has a venture firm called University Ventures, has a book called Unbundling Higher Education. And one of the things that we've been looking at is, how do we go about doing business in a different manner? How do we help unbundle how we're currently offering degrees and certifications?
Yes.
And I think that's sort of has been one of the authors and one of the books that's been helping us rethink higher education.
This might sound terrible, but I hope he doesn't actually listen to this ever. But it would actually be our funder, because he is certainly one of the most impatient and unreasonable people that I think any of us have ever interacted with. But it's exactly, I think, the type of personality that you need in ed tech, to really kind of push to the point where, you know, you think what's impossible, you know, because he really does accomplish things that you really never would have imagined. So it's been, I think, the driving force. I don't think we would have been able to do anything in terms of the investments or any of the companies we've had to interact with now without that sort of unreasonable push behind us.
Wonderful. And if people want to find out more, you guys are on Twitter. What's the Twitter handle?
Michelson20mm.
Okay, thanks so much, and have a great evening as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sophie.
A big big shout out to this week's sponsors, Glissa EDU. Glissa is an audience engagement platform, and they also have an education offer for socializing lectures, where they take regular PowerPoint or keynote presentations and push each slide out live to students' mobile devices as they are presented. Professors, administrators, and students get valuable data on where information is really engaging or needs reworking, and staff and students can interact through the deck. You can check them out at glissa.com/student-engagement. So I'm very excited to be here with the CEO and founder of Mindset. So Avi, welcome.
Thank you.
And Avi, what are you doing at South by Southwest EDU this year?
Well, first of all, we are three of Mindset team, and we are hosting a summit. We are leading a workshop and also a panel. And beside of these activities, it's always a great opportunity to meet everyone who's coming here. So, well, actually, we are now putting together an investors table, which it's a soft word for a small fund, actually, that it's going to be investing both in startups in Israel and in the UK, actually. And today I met an investor that already is committing to join this table. And we were discussing this remotely for a while, but I think the face-to-face interaction is really a very good way to
finalize things. Yeah. And can you share who the investor is?
I have to ask him. Actually, okay. I think he'll be happy to expose it, but maybe he would like to announce it more officially.
I've got some initials in my head, but I'm having a guess whilst we speak. And I mean, I guess part of this podcast is about the edtech trends that people are seeing here. So I guess you pick up different things at different events. Is there anything that you've spotted today or through your discussions that have kind of resonated with you as trends?
Well, actually, it's interesting for us to follow the VR trend. Last year, we were hosting here a summit around VR, and I think it was almost the only event in South by Southwest EDU around VR. Maybe there was one more or two more, but it was pretty rare. And this year, we saw lots of events around VR, AR, MR, which first shows how fast this trend is entering, at least as a buzzword. It's not necessarily reflecting what's happening in the field, but it's for this audience, it's became to be a very interesting and common thing in this 1 year alone, which is an interesting phenomena.
Yeah, and just going back to your investment fund, because it's the other questions are coming through. So when will that be live, and who will be applicable to apply to the funds?
Well, we're going to start with Israeli and UK-based startups. Yeah. We're looking for startups who have already up and running product and also users, and need their seed or even a bit after their pre-seed investment in order to grow. So I think it's a gap that we see both in Israel and the UK that we're trying to answer.
That's very true. I was at a government meeting there, and that was kind of one of the discussions around the table, was that, you know, you can get up, get going, and then there's this kind of gap, and that's the bit before you have that kind of massive round later on. And I mean, in terms of the educational problems that need solving, if you were to sort of rank the top five that you think actually this is why this is an interesting area to be in, and I mean, I think it's always refreshing to go back to actually what the problems that need solving. Yeah. So do you have an opinion on that?
Well, I think the basic and the most difficult problems are internal. I think it's the same problems always. I think maybe we are facing them more strongly because the pace of the changes, but I think there are about five eternal problems. One is motivation. It's always a challenge to create motivation with the learners. Another one is a heterogenic group or classroom. Whenever you have a system, you have to face this problem. Another one is the gap of how school can really prepare us to the world outside, with the relevance gap, we can call it. And maybe two more that are less clear, like first of all, clarity. It's always a challenge really to meditate in the right way. and also there is some tension between learning and educating, you know, bringing values and bringing knowledge. It's not always a clear cut, and yes. it's I think those problems are cannot be solved for forever. It's always a battle to solve them again and again.
And I remember I bumped into your colleague from Mindset, Cecilia, in London, and we ended up chatting a little bit about, she was very passionate about sort of learner-led and, you know, actually letting the learners themselves kind of take the direction. And I think we chatted about chatbots quite a lot, yeah. So as I understand it, that's kind of part of the framework for your event in a few weeks.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we're going to dedicate actually the event for a transition that we see from schooling to learning. And in a way, we see a few technological trends, and not just technological, let's say cultural and technological trends that are doing this transition. We're going to focus in one angle around AI, which lots of interesting opportunities there, mm-hmm. including chatbots. Another angle, which is more social angle, around startup or trying to narrow the gap between learning and schooling from the one hand and working and being part of the real world. And the third angle, it's more a cultural angle of self-motivated learners who are finding new teachers in a way. And we're yeah. going to focus on two phenomena. One is the YouTubers, which is a really, really fascinating thing. And kids really create the YouTubers or the new teachers.
Yeah, well, it's really interesting. I know they had a session here just on this floor actually about EdUtubers, or I think they called it. But so yeah, you've not only got the students doing it, and you know, I interviewed. Do you know? Have you heard of Urban Teacher before?
Yeah.
So I interviewed him. He was one of my first interviewees, and he said that he was once in the classroom. And a kid came up to him and told him he had a million views or something like this, some of the content he was developing. Yeah. And he's like, how am I even meant to handle this? Like, I don't even know what to tell this person. So, you know, being open to the idea that you don't know everything. But then you've also now got, including, I think, Urban Teacher, educators who are realizing that's an amazing platform as well to connect with those people.
What I found fascinating in this is the fact that the kids are following those YouTubers as personas, you know. It doesn't matter what they teach. They could teach one day gaming and one day chemistry and the other day how to create a bomb, but it's like they're like rock stars, you know. And
I was at another event and there was a guy there, has a literacy business, and he was saying that, you know, that's where kids read as well. They just, you know, they will spend hours reading the comments section, which isn't always the kind of bastion of great grammar and things like this. But like, that's a lot of communication goes on that platform. So it's kind of, how do you use that? How do you get there and make the most of that interaction as well?
Absolutely. And I think the first step probably is recognizing this is a legitimate channel. I can tell about my own son is about 14 years old. He's not reading at all. He has some learning disabilities, like most of the kids I know.
Yeah.
But he learns so much out of those YouTubers. And in a way, I think I had some discussion with his teacher, and I told her about this. And then in a way, really taking this seriously, I think it's really a challenge. And it's changing some kind of mindset. And also, it's not trivial because there are lots of crap that's running there.
And then it's not, you know, it's not a kind of safe space in terms of the comments section.
Absolutely.
Of strangers connecting with under 18 year olds and things like that. But yeah, the promise for learning when you are connected with the right thing, and it goes back to what you were saying, like the learner and connecting them with the right content, is massive. And you know, things like learning how to launch a podcast, like you know, there's so much great content on there, so it's really good. So if people want to contact you, it's at Mindset on Twitter, isn't it, I think?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also I have my own Twitter,
okay.
Which is my name with Avi Warshavsky in one word.
Yeah. Okay. All one word. So we'll put that in the show notes. And otherwise, Avi, have an amazing week.
Thank you very much.
And thanks for coming on the EdTech Podcast.
Thank you, Sophie.
So I'm here with Tomoko Haneda, representing EdTech Japan at South by Southwest EDU.
Oh, thank you very much. Konnichiwa. I am from Afflel Company, which created curriculum, coding curriculum for robotics learning people who learn robotics. So starting from K-12 to engineers.
How long has AFREL been going for?
Over a decade.
Oh, wow, okay. Mm-hmm. But obviously, and now there's a bit of a renaissance because of the coding curriculum mm-hmm. coming in 2020.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's totally different world right now. So
yeah. Yep. And so everyone's preparing in mm-hmm. the schools for teachers mm-hmm. to be able to teach this. Mm-hmm. And also some of the startups here are very much geared around
mm-hmm. yep.
helping to assist around coding and programming. Mm-hmm. So I met the chaps earlier from PET.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
So for those listening who are familiar with Cubetto, yep. it's quite a similar offering. Mm-hmm. So for early years children to understand mm-hmm. The basics of programming, I suppose.
Yeah, that could be. But yeah.
So what was your experience in terms of your own education and mm-hmm. how did you get into the edtech space?
No idea. And in my class, I didn't even use computer at all. I just did sewing.
Oh, really?
Yeah, girls do sewing.
Really?
And then boys do DIY stuff.
Wow.
So, and even had gender, depend on the gender, we had a different curriculum.
And is it different now?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we all have a common curriculum.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, we used to have a different curriculum for boys and girls.
And so with this delegation coming out to South by Southwest, how has that come about? Are you excited to all be here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What the objectives?
Have a global mindset and then focusing not only most Japanese startup easily think only Japanese, focusing on Japanese market.
Okay,
but
yeah.
Now we have to focusing see global
opportunity.
Yeah, opportunity, yeah. International opportunity. We have to try to have a market globally.
Yeah, so you're looking to essentially replicate an experience like this in Japan and mm-hmm. invite the international community over to
yes.
Tokyo.
Yeah.
Or,
yeah. Yeah. Because this time, so as you said, our delegation is getting bigger.
Yeah.
And because we could successfully approach to people in Japan to come out from Japan, but it's not that much.
Yeah.
So for Japanese to think globally, see other world, I think we better let more people experience having international business is fun. So
mm-hmm.
we have to we want experience more people to this kind of South by Southwest experience international investment as well.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. We have Japanese one too, but it's not much. So we always welcome that opportunity.
Yes, most yeah. people do.
Yeah, most people do. So, yeah, for that, I think.
And so if people are listening and they're interested to connect and partner with you, you have a Twitter account, don't you? Or the EdTech Japan one.
Yeah.
There's, I think it's EdTech_Japan.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll certainly find that out. And how about your own company? Are you on Twitter as well or on Facebook?
Yes, yeah. We have a Facebook and we'll open up the Twitter account.
Okay,
yeah.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. And so if you want to look into that more, it's AFREL, AFREL,
mm-hmm.
Limited, and Tomoko Haneda.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I'm TT Wandick. I'm part of the Pearson Affordable Learning Fund. It's a venture capital arm funded by Pearson to invest in affordable solutions in developing markets. Our thesis is that we want to drive efficacy and improve learning outcomes at a low-cost delivery method and mechanism. We're really trying to encourage entrepreneurs to focus on families that are low to middle income and at low resource environments in
okay.
these markets.
And so head of Asia, so which what's kind of encompassed in there, or which are the main countries that you focus on?
So the team in general, Paul, we've made investments in Africa, So South Africa, Ghana, India, and I lead our investments in Southeast Asia. And the way we look at it essentially is that we see a lot of catalytic behaviors and trends that are emerging there that are quite similar to other markets. We're focusing in tier one countries, which are Indonesia, Vietnam, and the Philippines, markets which are high density, under-resourced environments where there's just high willingness to invest in education.
And so this is about low-cost schooling as well that's of quality. So I saw your tweet earlier about, I think it was in Vietnam, that 40% of personal income goes on schooling or education. Could you tell us a little bit more about that model and, you know, what its purpose is in relation to, for example, the state's education that's already out there?
Absolutely. Fundamentally, we do believe what we're seeing is that some of the challenges that we're observing in Western countries in the United States and in London do apply in these markets. There are three challenges that everyone is trying to face and overcome. First is that fundamentally, there's still unequal access to high-quality education. The second part is that every student, any individual, a learner, a student, or adult learner, have varying learner needs and learn in different methods. And third component is that increasingly the world is changing. It's just that we need to step up the curriculum and delivery and pedagogy and systems to actually deliver and train graduates for the new 21st century skills and to be very quickly adaptive as automation and other like AI trends are going to start replacing jobs as we know it. Mm-hmm. In terms of specifically in Asia, what we're seeing is that the same trends that we've observed and solutions that we observe in these markets are translating in Southeast Asia in the sense that they're bringing down the cost of delivery of education. So infrastructure is being built up there. You have widespread use of low-cost devices that are being spread to places like Indonesia and the Philippines. You see high smartphone adoption at like 117% in some of these markets. So as a result, what we're seeing is that infrastructure is there. A lot of companies are now creating content. The next phase that we'll hopefully see are focusing on teacher training, mm-hmm. On the delivery side.
Because I think that's an important one, because I've sort of followed some of the articles around low-cost schools, and obviously, you know, there's different opinions out there, but I think one thing that some of the comments have addressed is whether, you know, when it's international teachers sort of coming in and the play with that, with the kind of local state education system. So I suppose, you know, in reply to that, the ability to train quality local educators is very important.
Absolutely. That's one of the biggest bottlenecks and often overlooked areas in innovation. Oftentimes it's conversation around edtech just as a talk of technology and students and sometimes parents, but teachers are something that are a catalytic event. Interesting solutions that we've seen right now are trying to address teacher training at very low-cost ways. I previously mentioned you a company in Myanmar, 360 Ed, that essentially are bringing virtual reality training to teachers so that they are able to transport them in environments outside of the country so that they are able to observe high-performance schools in the United States and charter schools. So those are the trends I think are very encouraging and are very low-cost solutions.
And with your VC hat on, where should people be paying attention? Obviously not other VCs, because that would be annoying for you. But in terms of trends within Asia or, you know, where you're kind of getting excited about investing?
Three things that I'm excited about in investing in Asia and then just also in observance in other markets. First are companies that are emerging around upward mobility and driving high employability. So upskilling, skills-based content. So the lynda.com mm-hmm. of, say, Vietnam or Indonesia, for instance, are emerging. And also English language training, partly because right now English The ability to acquire English is basically going to increase global competitive and regional competitiveness of these markets. The second trend that we're really interested in is what I alluded to earlier is teacher training. So these are pressure points that I think would actually fundamentally change the ecosystem and propel it. And the third component, a similar pressure point, is on basically educating parents as a delivery solution. Essentially, parents sometimes are the best, are the highest and most intimate touch points to the learners in which we want to reach ultimately. So as much as we can enable them to be upskilled and be trained to provide solutions or motivate students, I think that's also another investment opportunity.
And how about your own education? Because I always ask the interviewees, like, what was their own education like? So
mine is slightly conventional compared to a lot of students that we serve in these low-income families. I actually kind of started off as a scholarship student. I was born and raised in Thailand, to a Vietnamese family, was on scholarship to international schools, and eventually, fortunately, got a scholarship to go to Stanford University. I started neuroscience.
So yeah, tell us about neuroscience as well, because that was one of my questions. So, I mean, I think that's certainly within education within the UK at the moment, people are trying to work out how to take the information from neuroscience but not just kind of apply it willy-nilly to education, but how do you kind of translate that into what it might mean in the classroom?
So there are two ways I'm seeing neuroscience being applied to. One, in the AI sense, using neuromaps to basically try to identify patterns, and this is the technology behind all the artificial intelligence. I think that's tremendous opportunities to surface data and relevant, insightful actions for teachers and schools. The second neuroscience application is much more on the learning science behind a lot of the tools and products that we're using.
I hope you enjoyed this week's episode, everyone. Next week, we are back with the mindbender Ted Fujimoto as part of our South by Southwest Edu series. In the meantime, don't forget to register your interest for our event at London EdTech Week, fill in the listener survey, and have a great week.